from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Fred Goldman and his daughter Kim about the O.J. Simpson criminal and civil trials and how the murder of Ron Goldman has affected the family. The family has collaborated on a new book called His Name is Ron, Our Search for Justice. Also, we ask Henry Louis Gates about his thoughts on the two Simpson trials, and we discuss his recent New Yorker article on race and the theater. He has a new collection of essays called 13 Ways of Looking at a Black Man. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Bob Witten. The funeral for China's Deng Xiaoping will take place next Tuesday in Beijing's Great Hall of the People. The 92-year-old is to be cremated and his ashes scattered at sea. China is calmly receiving news of his death. A red flag at half-staff over Tiananmen Square is one of the few public signs of his passing. In Hong Kong, which is to revert to Chinese control later this year, Governor Chris Patten paid tribute to Deng. The BBC's Tim Leeward reports.
Mr. Patten joined many local business leaders as well as members of pro-China unions and other left-wing groups in visiting the offices of the Xinhua News Agency, China's de facto embassy in Hong Kong, to pay respects to the late Chinese leader. Mr. Patten said Deng would be regarded by future generations as one of the historic figures of the century.
It was his concept of one country, two systems, which provided the framework for Hong Kong's future after 1997.
But Mr. Patten and other officials have not gone as far as Beijing-controlled newspapers here, which have said the people of Hong Kong would deeply mourn Deng's death.
The BBC's Tim Leeward in Hong Kong. Boris Yeltsin's doctor denies published reports that the Russian president has Parkinson's disease. At the same time, the chief Kremlin physician says the 66-year-old is recovering from pneumonia and has agreed to cut back on his drinking. Three international experts have been named to settle the U.S. dispute with the European Union over investment in Cuba. From Brussels, NPR's Edward Lisson reports on the World Trade Organization action.
The director of the World Trade Organization, Renato Ruggiero, appointed Arthur Dunkel from Switzerland, Tommy Koh from Singapore, and Edward Woodfield from New Zealand. Europe objects to the 1995 U.S. Helms-Burton Law, which is an attempt to isolate Cuba. The law refuses U.S. visas to top executives of companies that trade with Cuba, and it opens those companies to prosecution in the United States. Almost every other country in the WTO argues that the Helms-Burton Law tries to extend U.S. policy beyond the U.S.'s borders. Europe took the case to the WTO, saying the law also violates open trade agreements. The U.S. claims the anti-Cuba law is a matter of national security, and therefore the U.S., although a WTO member, may not abide by the panel's ruling. Europe and the U.S. could still come to an agreement in the case on their own. If not, the panel appointed today has 6 to 9 months to come to a decision. In Brussels, I'm Edward Lipson reporting.
The Space Shuttle crew is stowing gear today in preparation for tomorrow's landing at the Kennedy Space Center. The Discovery team spent 10 days modernizing the Hubble telescope. Weather at landing time tomorrow is iffy, both in Florida and the alternate landing site in California. A very close encounter for the unmanned Galileo spacecraft just moments from now. It is to fly within 350 miles of Jupiter's frozen moon, Europa. Project managers say the craft is working perfectly. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update on Wall Street at noon Eastern Time, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 41.17 at 6978.95. Trading is active, 208 million shares. The Nasdaq Composite Index is down 10.39 at 1355.19. The Dow is thus down for the third straight business day. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports.
The stock market has been buffeted by a report in this morning's Wall Street Journal. It says the chief investment strategist at Goldman Sachs, Abby Cohen, believes the market can't rise at the rate it has since the beginning of the year. The Dow has gained nearly 10% in that time. Shares in semiconductor giant Intel are sliding after rival Cyrex Corporation introduced a lower-priced computer chip for PC makers. The day's economic news was mixed. Housing starts slowed in January, but manufacturing in the Philadelphia region improved this month. I'm Doug Krisner.
Construction of new homes and apartments rose 2% generally in January. Most work went on in the northeastern and western U.S., while work actually fell off in the Midwest and South. Time Warner now has a bigger piece of Court TV. The channel's founder, Stephen Brill, sold his share. He initially tried to buy out his other partners, but Time Warner Vice President Ted Turner wouldn't go along. He will stay with Court TV for 6 months and then move on. There's a big carrot dangling in front of the United States right now. American businesses are being offered the chance to bid on $1 billion worth of new contracts, but European and Japanese donors to a World Bank fund, which lends money to dozens of poor countries, hope the U.S. will buy down the problem. I'm Bob Whitten, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations. Contributors include the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting public understanding of technology, industry, and economic growth.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. During the O.J. Simpson civil trial, Judge Fujisaki placed a gag order on the Goldman family, forbidding them to publicly discuss the issues of the case. Now that the trial is over, the members of the Goldman family offer their perspective on the civil and criminal trials in their new book, His Name is Ron, Our Search for Justice. They also share some of their memories of Ron in the hopes that he will gain a public identity as a person, not just a victim. My guests are Ron Goldman's father, Fred Goldman, and Ron's younger sister, Kim Goldman. Kim and Ron were very close when they were growing up. Their birth mother, Sharon Ruffo, left the family when they were children and stayed pretty much out of their lives. Ruffo was a plaintiff in the civil trial. Yesterday, she agreed to settle for $1.3 of the $7.2 million in compensatory damages awarded by the jury in the civil case. I asked the Goldmans to compare how they felt after the criminal and civil trials.
After the criminal verdict, I was devastated and shocked beyond belief and outraged, and I felt cheated and disappointed, confused, scared, because the killer was going to be walking the streets. And then for the civil case verdict, I was pleased. I was proud of the efforts on behalf of our lawyers and the commitment that our family made, and that we stuck to that. It's all the same types of feelings, but, you know, it went the way that we had hoped it did this time. But the reality is still that he's out there, so.
Fred Goldman, what about you?
Well, I think for the criminal trial, I was devastated. I was absolutely numb for hours. It was too much for me to swallow. I was one in the family that, by the time we heard that there was a verdict, had pretty much decided in my own mind that the jury was going to find him guilty. I'd never thought beyond anything more than a hung jury, at the worst. But when that verdict came in, I was stunned, overwhelmed, shocked, crushed, hurt. I felt betrayed by the whole system, and certainly felt betrayed by the court. When it came to the civil trial, as Kim said, it was in good part effort that our attorneys had put forth, and we felt confident in what they were doing. But we had the experience of the criminal trial to deal with, and couldn't even go into the civil trial awaiting the verdict with some assurance that the right thing would occur. But when it did, I was relieved and elated. I was exactly the opposite that we had been, or I had been, during the criminal trial.
What was the difference in your roles in each trial?
Well, I think certainly we had a role in the civil trial. It was our case against the defendant. In the criminal, it's the state against the defendant. And we were babes in the woods, so to speak, during the criminal trial. There aren't a lot of rights available to the victims' families in a criminal trial, something that's very sad to me. But certainly we had the input, the opportunity to discuss the things that we were going to do or not going to do during the civil trial, and at least we felt some involvement and some satisfaction.
What is the biggest thing you wanted to see done differently in the civil trial than was done in the criminal trial?
Well, I think that We were hoping, and our attorneys agreed, that they were going to put on a much more condensed case, much cleaner, everything to the point, not spend weeks and weeks on DNA and get confusing with heavy technicalities. So that there was a lot of things, I think, that were done differently. That was primarily one.
How much money are you actually expecting to see? I know money isn't the issue to you, but
we've never ever discussed it.
No, I don't. In fact, when we heard the compensatory damages,
I didn't even hear it until it was reported on the news.
Then the punitive damages, we never had one bit of discussion about the dollar amount.
Never.
The only thing that struck me about those two awards, I guess, judgments, was that I looked at it as the jury sending a message of how much punishment they wanted to mete her out.
Fred Goldman, when did you decide to issue the challenge to O.J. Simpson that if he signs a confession, he wouldn't have to pay any of the damages?
It was during a radio interview roughly a week ago, and it was somewhat off the top of my head. I had heard a radio talk show host in L.A., a favorite of mine, a man by the name of Larry Elder, and he had made a comment about something pretty much almost exactly to that effect the day before as I was listening to his program, and it struck me as kind of an interesting idea when I heard him mention it. And then a day or so later, I'm posed with the question about the issue of the monetary awards, and my response was as it was, that it meant nothing to me, and that if he wanted to sign a confession and have it broadcast all over the nation and all over the world, I'd be glad to ignore the judgment.
What would that do for you, the public confession?
Well, I think it would be further acknowledgement, public acknowledgement of his guilt.
We've only wanted him to take responsibility and the responsibility be placed on him for being a murderer. And if he signed a confession and it was published and it was under penalty of perjury and all of the other, you know, legal mumbo-jumbo, so to speak, then we would have proved our point beyond what the jury already found. He would have finally had to agree to it. And if anyone, you know, pays attention to what we say as a family and what we stand for, then it shouldn't have been a shock that my dad made that comment, because that's what we've always maintained.
Did O.J. Simpson ever say anything to either of you during the trial, express his sympathy about Ron?
No, he always would cast his eyes down on me. He would look me up and down as if I was prey for him. He would bat his eyelashes at me, pout his lips as in an appearance of a poor baby look. He was pointing at me, mocking me, laughing at me.
He'd point at you mockingly?
He would point at me, and there was one occasion there was a reporter standing in between us, and I was staring at him, and he turned the reporter around, and he pointed at me, and he says, "See what I deal with on a 24-hour day basis? Look what she does to me. Look at her staring at me." I mean, he said it loud enough so that I could hear it. He sent someone over to me in the hallway one day, some woman that he claims is a friend of his. I don't know who she is. And she came up, and she tried to block my view of him, and I was, you know, persistent to just continue looking. And I told her that she was ineffective for what she was trying to do. And then she leaned over in my ear and she whispered, "He's pretty good looking to stare at, isn't he?" And I looked at her and I was appalled. And then the killer started laughing and his bodyguard started laughing. And they all thought that was pretty funny. And unfortunately, the media sees that and never reported it. They only report me glaring at him. They don't report the disgusting looks that he gives back to me.
Yeah, I want to say here that you refer to O.J. Simpson only as the killer in your book. You never mention him by name. That must be a conscious decision that you made.
No, yes, it is.
You know, actually, I don't think it was a conscious decision. It just became what he was, because we never called him by his name to begin with. It was always him or you know who, and then it became the defendant. And then when we all, you know, individually thought that he was guilty, that's just what it became. We didn't sit down and say, okay, we're going to start calling him the killer.
Right.
That's just what it was. And calling him anything else gives him a personality which I don't think he deserves. And people that are around us, our lawyers, everybody calls him the killer. I correct people that are around me when they use his name because it's uncomfortable for me. When waiters come up and they want to offer us that kind of juice. You know, we even correct the waiter sometimes because I cannot stand to hear his name. And it's actually even when reporters use him just by first name. That's actually even more offensive to me when they don't even use his full name. They just call him by his first name as if he's their buddy. It's really troublesome to me.
Your lead lawyer during the civil trial, Daniel Petrocelli, said that if O.J. Simpson, he said this in court, if O.J. Simpson were innocent, would he let his lawyer mock Ron Goldman? This young man tried to save the life of the mother of his children. He is a hero to O.J. Simpson.
Right.
Is this something you had talked about before?
No. Dan did that totally on his own.
And it's amazing because when I heard that, I thought, oh, my God. That's it. I never even thought of that. The only image that I have of the killer and my brother is of rage and violence and murder. I would never have attached. It was very strange for me to hear that because hearing that sort of made the killer have this warmth about my brother, and I just never ever experienced that feeling. So when Dan said it, I thought, oh my God, that's exactly right. It's exactly right. It just blew me away when he said that.
Do you wish the civil trial had been televised, or do you think it was better off without the televisions?
I personally wish it had been televised.
Me too.
I think that there were benefits and drawbacks to the cameras in the criminal trial. The benefit was that a nation had a chance to see a criminal trial in all its absurdities at work, and I think it terrified and scared a lot of people in this country. The positive or the negative was that it wasn't controlled, and it became the background for theatrics beyond belief.
But it also gave way to the 13th juror and the country as a whole. Viewed the evidence for themselves, and yes, you're supposed to accept the verdict, but in this case, the country was able to watch the case and judge for themselves, and for the majority of the country, they all thought he was guilty. Now, in the civil case, it was the defense who did not want the cameras in the courtroom. They didn't want it, and they vehemently opposed it, and that was, we lost that, but I think we're all in favor of it. I think that the country deserved to see that the law can work sometimes.
Can I add one thing to that?
Yeah, please.
I think that it's a shame that the nation didn't have a chance to hear the testimony of the defendant. They would have heard, as we did, one lie after another, after another, after another. And perhaps if people had heard themselves, they would have been more willing to, in many cases, believe that the verdict in the criminal trial was, in fact, unjust.
But not only that, his demeanor on the stand. I mean, the perception was just because he didn't blow up or break down on the stands mean he did incredible. Well, when you watched him on the stand, he was fidgeting around. He was staring at the walls. He was, you know, visibly uncomfortable. And that's something that lacks when you try to repeat, you know, the information to the public, so...
You know, in the book, you say that you liked the way Judge Fujisaki handled the courtroom. He was a no-nonsense judge. But he also put a gag order on the family. You weren't allowed during the trial to address the issues of the case in public. How did you feel about that gag order?
Well, I personally found it difficult. But I understood the judge's reasons for doing it. He didn't want to have anything remotely similar to what had occurred during the criminal trial. So I respected certainly his reasons for wanting the gag order. It was difficult to maintain a silence. But when all was said and done and we received the verdict that we had hoped for, I can say that the difficulty was well worth the wait.
Yeah, I absolutely agree that... at the time when it first happened, it was very frustrating, and you know, to be under someone else's control, to be told what you can and cannot say, and always be wondering if what you said was pushing the envelope. But looking back at it now, I'm extremely grateful that we had a gag order, because had you know we been you know competing with the other side to constantly be putting a spin on things and everyone's opinion and trying to justify what I mean, it just would have been nuts. I mean, in the prosecutors in the criminal case, they never really spoke out that much, and we constantly were listening to the defense attorneys and their yammerings. So I was grateful that we didn't have to do that this time.
My guests are Kim and Fred Goldman. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Ron and Kim Goldman. The Goldman family has a new book called His Name is Ron, Our Search for Justice.
I think one of the really incredible parts of your book is the very beginning where you transcribe the phone answering machine tape.
Yeah,
from his house. And first there's a lot of friends just checking in, wanting to see what he's doing tonight and where was he yesterday. And then the friends start calling back saying, hey, I heard your name on the news. Could it be this is you? I hope it's not you. You know, maybe you'll never even respond to this message. It's just a chilling transcription. You must have just...
Well, we have not heard the actual tape.
You didn't?
We only have the transcripts, and...
Was the tape used as evidence or something?
A reporter from the criminal case came across it. I have no idea. She won't tell me. But she wrote a beautiful story about it, and she gave me the transcripts way back when in the criminal case, and I've always held on to them. And when we were talking with the authors for the book, it came up, and I had them, and we gave them to them. And I'll tell you that I've read them a minimum 10, 15 times, and each time it destroys me. It just brings me to the absolute breaking point. Because you can also hear the frustration and the anxiety in those messages just by reading them. You can hear how scared his friends must have been, and
Fred Goldman, I know that at least one person has offered you an untraceable gun so that you could shoot O.J. Simpson. Did you have direct contact with this person?
Yeah, that was a terrifying experience. I was on a business call easily a year ago, maybe a little longer ago, and I was leaving an office complex, and someone called out my name and came up to me and offered their condolence, etc., and then proceeded to tell me that if I wished, they could get me a high-powered rifle with a scope that I could kill you-know-who with. And I was just shocked, and I said, no, thank you, and I started to walk away. And this person kept walking with me and said, well, you know, if you don't want to do it yourself, we can find somebody to do it for you. And I said, you know what, I don't want anything to do with this conversation. And I left. It was a scary experience, one that those kind of folks are walking around out there, and two, that they would even dream that I would have any interest in that. That's not how any of us in our family conduct our lives. And it wouldn't be something that I'd ever have any interest in doing. It's easy to be angry and vengeful. It's another thing to act it out.
Exactly. And I'm wondering, I'm sure you've both had revenge fantasies that you wouldn't dream of acting out. But I think it's normal to have the revenge fantasies and then healthy to keep those fantasies
in check. That's exactly right. Most of us make those conscious decisions not to act out our frustration or our anger in a violent way. We make those decisions every day, and it makes us different from those violent individuals in our society, those criminals, etc., who choose just the opposite reaction. We're not about to sacrifice any of us to violence and lower ourselves to that level.
There's been so many changes in both your lives since Ron's murder. Fred Goldman, you had been a salesman in corrugated cardboard, and during much of the criminal trial, you had to still keep going to work. As you say in your book, you had a mortgage to pay, and
right.
So you couldn't afford to just leave your job. But now now you have a different position. You're a national spokesman for a group called Safe Streets, whose goal is to reform the criminal justice system and cut down on crime. Did your job become more kind of meaningless to you as, like, after your son was killed?
The answer is yes. The passion that I had had for my job of nearly 30 years began to dwindle as I realized there were other issues, other things that were taking precedence. And the more time that went by, the more angry and frustrated I became with a system that didn't seem to be to care much for decent, honest folks, didn't seem to care much for victims or their families, a system broken. And fortunately, I was given the opportunity to join Safe Streets, an organization that has very similar beliefs to mine, and that if we can affect some change in the criminal justice system to make it more, if I can use a bit of a corny term, user-friendly, to make it more understanding of the people that it's there to protect. And if it's not doing those things properly, and if it's not protecting the public, then it's not doing its job.
I wonder if either of you would have, I know you both wanted to see a conviction for O.J. Simpson during the criminal trial. Would you have wanted him to get the death penalty?
Only if it would have been administered, like, right away. I don't believe, I have a hard time with the death penalty only because, people sit on death row for 30, 40 years, and they don't ever go to the death to the death chamber. And I think that if you're going to put someone on death row, then you give them a certain number of appeals. You have a certain X amount of years to, you know, try to overturn your judgment against you, and then that's it.
Kim, did your brother's murder change your opinions about the death penalty?
Yes. I like to think of myself as a liberal thinker, and I was a psych major, so I was of the thinking that, you know, everyone deserves a second chance. You can rehabilitate. There's got to be some reason. You know, I was always trying to figure out the other side, and when this happened, I'll tell you, in about a split second, I threw all that out the window, and I said, I don't care what the other side was. I don't care why this person did this to my brother. He deserves the same pain and anguish that he inflicted on my brother, and I wanted to be there to watch, and I've never experienced that type of feeling, and I feel very strongly about that. I mean, an eye for an eye, and I never, ever felt that way before. And a lot of people criticize that, and my only answer is you just don't know until you're in that position.
Kim and Fred Goldman. The Goldman family has a new book called His Name is Ron, Our Search for Justice. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we ask Henry Louis Gates for his thoughts on the O.J. Simpson trials. He writes about Simpson in his new collection of essays, 13 Ways of Looking at a Black Man. We'll also discuss his recent New Yorker article on race and the theater. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Henry Louis Gates has been writing about race and culture in an ongoing series of fascinating articles in the New Yorker magazine. Gates chairs the Afro-American Studies Department at Harvard. He's an editor of the new Norton Anthology of African-American Literature and the Dictionary of Global Culture. And he has a new book called 13 Ways of Looking at a Black Man, a collection of his New Yorker pieces, including profiles of Louis Farrakhan, Colin Powell, and Harry Belafonte. The title piece is about interpretations of the O.J. Simpson criminal trial. Gates told me he knows a lot of people who thought Simpson was guilty after the criminal trial and changed their minds after the civil trial.
Most of the people I talked to about the O.J. verdict when I was writing the piece for The New Yorker were people like my barber, my daughter's hairdresser, a secretary at the office. I wanted to know what just regular people thought about O.J., shoeshine people, people on the streets, some of the homeless people. I interviewed all these people because I initially planned to do a piece like that, sort of the person on the street kind of piece, but the black person on the street or the person within the working class of the African-American community. And everybody within that group had a theory about the mafia doing it or that there was some conspiracy or Mark Furman and his buddies had set O.J. up. So I went back to a lot of these people I see on a regular basis in the grocery store or in the daily course of a week. And nobody, I repeat, nobody is defending O.J.'s innocence now. I think shoes did the brother in.
It was funny, you know, you wrote a little bit about conspiracy theories, and you described them as being irresistible labor-saving devices in the face of complexity. I thought that was very interesting way of putting it.
Well, one of the things that I tried to point out was that the black community has been in the grip of conspiracy theories for generations and generations. I think because of the particular history of oppression of black people in this country, the degree of conspiracy theories is probably cubed compared to that in the rest of the population, whether crack was a conspiracy by the CIA or AIDS was a conspiracy to wipe out the African-American male, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But whether or not there really was a conspiracy, when people look around and look at the state of Afro-America, they see devastation and they reach for large-scale, sometimes fantastical explanations to account for that kind of terror and pain, and both of which produce an enormous amount of anxiety.
In your piece about O.J. after the criminal trial, you wrote that your worst fear is to have to go before the criminal justice system. Why is that your worst fear?
Well, I think that we all have that fear. I wrote that just after the section in the essay when I'd interviewed so many of my friends, people like William Joyce Wilson or Cornel West, Anthony Appiah, and asked them if they had had brushes with the police. And they said, looked at me like I was crazy and said, of course we've all had brushes with the police. And so, of course, have I. I worry about being a black person victimized by a racist jury. And I think that could happen to any of us. If I see a flashing light in my rearview mirror, panic and terror set in. And it doesn't matter, I think, whether you are a wealthy person, whether you have a group of credentials as long as you are as your arm. When you think about Rodney King, you think, there but for the grace of God go I. And I still feel that way. When I moved to Lexington, Massachusetts, which is, I no longer live there, but it's a wonderful upper middle class suburb, about 25,000 people, I found an excuse to go by the Lexington Police Department to let them know that it was I who would be driving through there late at night on my way home, not somebody who was on the prowl trying to rip off the local wonderful inhabitants of Lexington, Massachusetts. It's a very embarrassing thing to admit. It's a humiliating thing to have to do, but I admit it and I did it. And I think it's that kind of paranoia or that kind of response that results from terrible experiences with the police being, we call it DWB, driving while black, that leads to all sorts of aberrant behavior.
So what kind of response did you get from the police when you notified them you were moving in?
Well, when I would drive through Lexington late at night, there was a police officer there. He would wave to me, and I would wave to him right after I tooted my horn at him, just reminding him of who I was. But again, I feel so vulnerable, and I think this is true of other African-American males, when you're pulled over by a policeman. They can do anything to you. They can make any claim. They can plant things on you. And if we think that's paranoia, just ask Mark Furman.
Henry Louis Gates is my guest, and his new book, 13 Ways of Looking at a Black Man, is a collection of pieces that he's written for The New Yorker magazine. You know, we recently broadcast the town hall debate in New York about race, cultural power, and theater, a debate between August Wilson, a playwright who's African-American, and Robert Brustein, a theater critic and director who's white. And your latest New Yorker piece was about that debate and about the black theater that's kind of left out of that debate. The debate is about whether African-Americans in theater should stick to theater that's written, directed by, and stars blacks, and if they sell out their cultural identity by participating in predominantly white theater. Your piece was about that debate, but also about what's being called the new Chitlin circuit in theater. And I'd like you to describe what that circuit is.
African-American culture has always had its own organizations, its own forms, its own social structures. I mean, it had to have. The people from slavery times couldn't participate in the outlets of the larger society. And so they formed their own. They formed their own rituals to get married. They formed their own social clubs, fraternities, sororities, churches, and as it happens, their own theaters, their own forms of entertainment. And you cut to the 1920s, an organization called TOBA, which was nicknamed Tough on Black Asses, formed a black national theatrical network that would feature plays and comedy routines and blues singers, classic blues singers like Bessie Smith and Mamie Smith, jazz groups, every possible form of entertainment that you can think of in the secular world. And this was called the Chitlin Circuit. It would come to Cumberland, West Virginia, where my father was a boy, in the following form. There were no black buildings, no buildings owned by black people. So they would rent one of the local ballrooms or the local auditorium at the colored school or something like that. If they rented a movie theater or an organization that had another life in the daytime, they would wait until, say, midnight and have an all-colored show. And so my father saw Duke Ellington and Count Basie there in midnight performances that would go on to 2 or 3 o'clock, and they would sell fried chicken and baked sweet potatoes and chitlins. And so it was called the Chitlin Circuit.
What's the new Chitlin Circuit like okay. in the theater?
Well, the new Chitlin Circuit, the first time I heard about this, frankly, was from my buddy Cornel West, who told me about a play that he had gone to see with his wife in Philadelphia called Only the Strong Survived. And I said, well, who wrote that? He said, well, nobody wrote it. You would not know who wrote it. But the point is, everyone in the black community, working class black people, flocked to see plays like Only the Strong Survive. And then he told me about the plot, and we both cracked up. It was just funny. He said risque humor and sexual and gendered stereotypes, and he said it was enormously popular. So I filed that away for about a year, and then Brustein and August Wilson get into this debate. And I think about the sort of things that August Wilson is demanding, that black theater by us, for us, and about us, echoing unwittingly, no doubt, the call in 1926 by W.E.B. Du Bois for an all-black theater, what he called a Negro theater. So I was thinking about how would that be funded? And then I remembered what Cornell said about this play called Only the Strong Survive. And I start making a few phone calls, and I find out that there is a play called My Grandmother Prayed for Me playing at the Newark Symphony Hall. And I jump on a plane one Sunday afternoon, and I land in at the Newark airport, and I take a car over to the Newark Symphony Hall, and there, along with 3,000 people, on a Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock, each of us paying $24.50, I watched one of the funniest, most hilarious, off-color, risque, melodramatic, corny, kitschy, schlocky works of art that I'd ever seen, and it was My Grandmother Prayed for Me. And there are dozens and dozens and dozens of these plays, and they're playing the packed houses from coast to coast. That is the contemporary Chitlin Circuit. They're either kitschy, schlocky comedies or embarrassing melodramas involving God and angels and crackheads and inner city despair, all of which is mysteriously, magically cured through a miracle by a God who manifests himself either in his own person or through one of his angels. It was amazing.
Now you write that these shows kind of make the TV series Good Times look like Strindberg.
That's right.
And you also say that all the very worst stereotypes of African Americans are on display here, larger than life. What kind of stereotypes did you see?
A large woman who's the grandmother, who is overly religious, gendered sexual stereotypes are there. Gay stereotypes about limp wrist gay men, hypersex black women, hypersex black men, affinity for drugs, laziness, shiftlessness. They're all there. I mean, as I say in the piece, had a white person written this, Jesse Jackson and the NAACP would have linked arms and called us all to boycott that kind of work. But of course, a white person didn't write it. It was an act of the community for the community, and the community comes out in droves to laugh at itself and even a stereotypical representation of itself.
My guest is Henry Louis Gates. His new collection of New Yorker articles is called 13 Ways of Looking at a Black Man. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Henry Louis Gates, we're talking about his recent New Yorker article on race and theater.
So what does it say for you that, you know, while August Wilson is calling for a theater that's by blacks and about African Americans, his theater is actually seen, I think, by a predominantly white audience. But the audience that's really turning out for African American theater, the African American audience that's turning out, is turning out for an African American theater that is, yes, it's black themed, but as you say, it's really kind of schlocky and stereotyped.
Well, I wanted to put the lie to the notion that black people don't go to theater, just like a few years ago, it was commonly thought among publishers that black people didn't buy books. And last year, we know black people bought 160 million books. Black people, we know, also flock to the theater. They just don't flock to Broadway. And the reason it was important to do that is that August Wilson's argument turned on the government or private philanthropies subsidizing black theaters in cities with a population of over 60%. And it seemed to me that that's not the way to build a solid theatrical base. In fact, that's why I cited the relationship between the Ford Foundation and the Negro Ensemble Company and the New Lafayette Theater in the 1960s. I set it up as an allegory to say that, look, it didn't work then, it's not going to work this time. We need to subsidize theater in the way that everybody's theater is subsidized, which is from various sources. One from the board of directors, one from the federal government, obviously to a less and less extent over the last few years, and from people just reaching into their pocket and paying for tickets. And our people will do that. We have established that they would do that. They just won't do it for August Wilson's plays. So the challenge implicitly that I tried to pose to August and for those of us, including me, who want to see strong, healthy cultural institutions within the African-American community, is for us to figure out how to get the people who sat around me at the Newark Symphony Hall in to see Fences or Two Trains Running or whatever the play might be. That is the challenge.
But it's the same thing as, like, more people are going to go see Cats than Stephen Sondheim. I mean, you know, I think in a lot of ways people have romanticized what it means to make art for the people. And whenever this kind of almost ideological sense of, like, populism and democracy enters art, it sometimes gets really confusing because it's often true that the art that reaches the most people isn't necessarily a politically populist art. It's kitsch.
Oh, without a doubt. But I want to see black cultural institutions, those people responsible for appealing to or attempting to attract a black popular audience into theaters, to begin to analyze what it is that black people respond to. We have a tremendously sophisticated sense of taste when it comes to music, for obvious reasons. And we have had a sophisticated sense of music for a very long time. I mean, no one passes off kitschy music to African Americans. I mean, they understand what's good and what's not, and that's good. We don't have that counterpart or that equivalent of the sophistication and taste in our theatrical, in the theatrical realm. So why not have a theater that uses the advertising seduction techniques used on the Chitlin Circuit, which I just describe in the piece, as well as different kind of programming. I mean, high art, middlebrow art, and rank lowbrow art, meaning Moms Mabley and Red Fox, both of whom, by the way, were, I think, geniuses and products of the Chitlin Circuit. There's nothing wrong with that. I think that just as in the 1960s, we accepted the notion that the people were ignorant and they had to understand the new black political manifestos being produced by artists such as Leroy Jones, who's now Amiri Baraka, or Ed Bullins, and this is by their own admission, by the way, and they had a very arrogant attitude toward the African-American community. So, too, I think, 30 years later, we have an arrogant attitude toward people telling them that they don't know what they like or they shouldn't like what they do like, and we haven't figured out how to transform that impulse to go to the theater onto a higher level. That is what I think the challenge is, and that's why I ended the piece with a quotation from Ed Bullins, who's right here in Boston at Northeastern and is, a very sophisticated playwright, who is trying to get his plays on that Chitlin circuit to tap into that potential audience, a large audience, much larger than any other theatrical audience in the history of the black community.
It would be interesting to see what happens, to see if the people respond to his plays.
Yeah, you don't seem very optimistic.
Well, I don't know. It seems like 4 years in many different cultures, people have felt if only excellent art had the right advertising or the right positioning that everybody would flock to see it. I'm not always convinced that that's true.
Well, I agree with you there, but I think that there is always a segment of an audience as large and as diverse as the one that I've just described, that wants a bit more, wants something more sophisticated. And I think that's where Bullen's potential resides.
I wonder where you see yourself as a writer fitting into this debate about what art truly speaks to the community. I mean, I have heard people say about you, oh, Henry Louis Gates, he doesn't really speak for the African-American community.
Well, they're absolutely correct. I'm just trying to speak for myself.
Right.
I can't. I don't want the burden of being responsible for or accountable to 35 million other African Americans. I mean, that's not my job. That's not my profile. It's hard enough to figure out what you believe about an issue and then to shape it into some sort of meaningful form without worrying about, will I offend the black community or will what I write be harmful to the black community? You have to be free to call it the way that you see it. What I try to do is replicate the effect of that conversation within the race, as my father might say, but for a broader audience. And I think that's what art does. I think that the genius of James Joyce is that he writes with enormous particularity about the customs and mores of a stratum of the Irish community early in the century. But that is merely backdrop for larger, more fundamental questions. It's the same way that Shakespeare used Denmark, right? Do you read Hamlet to learn about the order of succession of Danish kings? I mean, absolutely not. You read it to learn about basic fundamental human emotions. And to a much lesser extent than God knows James Joyce or William Shakespeare, as a journalist, I am trying to unveil, to use Du Bois's great metaphor, a life within the race for a larger audience, and to do that with as much freedom and effectiveness that I, with my own limitations, can muster. That is the challenge of each of these pieces to me. I mean, that is what it's almost as if I feel that I have a mission. And that mission, I'm not to be corny or to make too big a point of it, but my mission is to record my generation of African Americans for posterity and for my contemporaries in the larger society. And that's why a piece like the Chitlin Circuit excited me so much, because here's something that the larger culture didn't know about. I could report on it. In fact, many African Americans didn't know about it. And I can report on it, but then use it to talk about larger issues of theater and representation, authenticity, interracial debates, new forms of casting, et cetera, et cetera.
Now, one of the things that you revealed, which I had no idea about in your piece about African-American theater in the Chitlin Circuit, is that some of the plays in the theater circuit are basically produced by drug dealers. That the money backing some of these shows is drug money. And one playwright who wrote who wrote a play that was produced in such a way said, you know, that he really had a problem because here he was writing a play about all the things that are killing African-American men. And, of course, the play is being subsidized by drug money. I mean, what bigger paradox is there? What reaction did you get to this revelation?
That was James Chapman, who wrote a very popular play called Our Young Men Are Dying and No One Seems to Care. And again, I'm just working my way through this world, and he starts to tell me all these experiences, which I put in the piece, about running up against drug dealers and enormous amounts of cash, because these guys, one, have to launder their money, or I don't know if that's laundering money, but moving one large source of cash from here over to there, and also wanting to make money, large sums of money, in ways other than dealing drugs. And he said that there was so much money being made on the Chitlin circuit that these guys had enough cash to rent a hall. They would go and look at them. They would sit through a production of Beauty Shop or whatever the play might be, and they, or else they would hire one of the people who had written one of these plays and say, write me a play, and then they would put it on, they would hire the actors, and they would make enormous amounts of money, too. I was astonished at how much money was being made on the Chitlin circuit, and I think that that would help to motivate many of the other artists to try to emulate the techniques of marketing in the Chitlin circuit, because they want to make that money too. But Chapman's description made me realize how dangerous it was and how corrupt that world can be. I think that there's a sort of different degrees of excellence or sophistication within the Chitlin circuit. On the high end, you have people like James Chapman and Shelley Garrett, the author of Beauty Shop, which is the all-time champion of the Chitlin circuit proceeds. And on the lower end, I'm afraid you have this element that Chapman describes in my piece.
My guest is Henry Louis Gates. He has a new collection of New Yorker articles called 13 Ways of Looking at a Black Man. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Henry Louis Gates is my guest. His new book, 13 Ways of Looking at a Black Man, is an anthology of essays that he's written for The New Yorker magazine. The theme of so many of your pieces is the meaning of racial identity at the end of the millennium.
Mm-hmm.
You came of age yourself at a period of great racial consciousness and identity. For, you know, it was a period of great African-American consciousness-raising militancy, a period of feminism, the beginning of the gay rights movement, when you were in college in the late 60s, early 70s. It was the When the Revolution Comes era.
That's right. Good old days.
Yeah. No, I'm wondering how coming of age during a period of such radicalism and often of such kind of ideology and towing the line-ism affected your view of politics, culture, and the arts. I mean, your view of where ideology began and what was dangerous about towing the line.
Well, I think that I was blessed by coming from a background in the country, a rural background, so that I would go up I was a student at Yale, as you know, and there was all of this political rhetoric, and I was so eager to be black, quote-unquote, to be an authentic black person. And I knew whatever I'd come from in the hills of West Virginia could not possibly be authentic blackness. So I got my dashiki, and I grew my afro. I had an afro by the time I got to Yale, but I let it grow more. And I volunteered to be secretary of the Black Student Association, the political organization, so I would be the scribe of the revolution, and I could learn the lines, you know, I could watch it up close. And the difference between the way people talked in a political meeting and what they allowed themselves to say and cheer and applaud. And then what they said behind closed doors or what they said when they were back with their parents during the holiday really threw me for a loop. I would go back and repeat some line to my father and my mother, and they would say, my mother would say, Skippy, you can't really believe that, do you, baby? You know, like, are you out of your mind? And
give me an example.
They're not easy, quick things, though, but they're things like, well, we're going to take over. Black people are going to all rise up. You know, we're going to defend ourselves against the police, and maybe we'll colonize a state, or if it doesn't work out, if they don't give us our rights, we're all going to split and go back to Africa. And, you know, my father would say, compared to what? You know, like, are you out? Are you crazy? You know, we're not going anywhere. There ain't going to be no revolution. The white man's going to wipe out your revolution in about 15 seconds. You better study that calculus and physics and get yourself to medical school and stop hanging around with all these black people with big afros and dashikis like you have on. I think that I grew skeptical of, I mean, we were all just kids, and but we believed. And what I tried to retain was that sense of concern, that sense of service for the African-American community, which is what this was all about mm-hmm. for our generation of college kids, but to discard the rhetorical baggage. And more particularly in my case, and I think that this is something, or I hope this is something that comes out in my pieces, to attack and to challenge ideological bullies whenever they manifest themselves. And those are the people I can't stand, and I'm always going to attack them, because I think that if there are 35 million African-Americans, there are 35 million ways to be an African-American, to be black, and that no one has a right to insist that someone else is inauthentic with their blackness. What blackness is a sum total of what we all are individually as a people, rather than the other way around, that someone issues a memo and says, this is what blackness is today, and you have to repeat this after me. That kind of groupthink, I think, is disgusting.
Well, Henry Louis Gates, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Henry Louis Gates has a new collection of essays called 13 Ways of Looking at a Black Man. He chairs the Afro-American Studies Department at Harvard. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu and Tracy Tenenbaum. Research assistance from Siobhan Roth. Regina O'Toole is our intern. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House, publishers of Whitaker Chambers, a biography by Sam Tenenhouse. This is NPR, National Public Radio.